Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. My name is Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
And we've got a superb episode coming up today with the journalist, music writer, author Laura Barton, which is really, really fun, this one. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I've liked Laura Barton's writing for a long time, and I think she writes really brilliantly about, and kind of unashamedly emotionally about, music, which is what I've always really liked. And I think, as you sort of say in the podcast, I feel like I'm kind of a similar generation, so it feels like we kind of grew up on a lot of the same things, which kind of includes the kind of Beatles revivalism of the 90s. So it was a really interesting one.
Yeah, and she's also recently had a fantastic BBC radio series there's a couple of episodes. One's about the sort of intensity of falling in love with music when you're the age of 17.
Yeah, just 17, yeah.
Yeah, so we talk about that bit, and then there's also a brilliant episode about sad music and what that sort of means, and the people who have a kind of attraction to the melancholy.
The BBC Radio 4 show is called Notes on Music, and there's a brilliant episode about happy and sad music and what makes sad music. And one of the things we talk about in this episode is this kind of the idea that this kind of descending chord sequence or descending line is often something that you find in melancholy music. And, you know, we go right back to Purcell or Purcell. You know, I say how often it's used in Beatles songs, and then I can only think of one example, which is Dear Prudence. So I've got the guitar. No, there's loads. I mean,
it's hundreds.
There's hundreds. So the thing is that's interesting is Paul McCartney does this thing a lot, which is called a line cliché. Have you heard of a line cliché?
I don't think I have.
It's where you get a one chord, but a line descends all the way down.
Oh, right. Through. I just didn't know that was the name for it.
So, you know, that's a that's a good one. And you got Eleanor Rigby. Fixing a Hole. You know, it's all over Paul McCartney stuff.
The intro of Strawberry Fields. I mean, yeah, it's probably more in more songs than not. In some,
exactly. But that's what's interesting, because it goes back to what we were talking about with the Jeff Lloyd. John in India seemed to start doing that as well, because you've got Dear Prudence and, you know, and you've got Cry Baby Cry. You know, so I just love that kind of, there must have been some kind of interaction happening there, because it seems like John was less technically inclined to do those kind of chord progressions than Paul. But something, I do think something happened in India.
And we go into a lot of detail about why that sort of might be a sort of slightly kind of lacrimose chord progression or whatever it is. But that's just one of loads of great chats. I mean, it's not one of our most Beatle-heavy ones. We go really around the houses, but it always ends up coming back. One connection being that Laura once had a fat cat called Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's always an avenue to get back to home. There's also some really great chats about interviewing some of her heroes, including Van Morrison, which didn't go particularly to plan. We cover loads of stuff. It's all really great. So, we really hope you enjoy this one.
Yeah.
Before we get started, I'm just going to read out a couple of emails. Got quite a few good ones this week. So keep sending them in to jack@homespunsounds.com, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. This email is from Leo Humphreys, who says, "Hello!" exclamation mark. Recently, while down a Beatles Wikipedia rabbit hole, I found myself on a page for a collection of Beatles oldies, the Beatles' first compilation album released in December 1966. which we talked about in the last series of the show at some point, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah.
One that your dad had or something.
My nana had it. It was just very weird that it came out there, and it was called Oldies, sort of wild. Yeah. You know, then there was some songs
Beatles
that could
have been less than 10 years.
Yeah.
So he says, there in the track list, quite inexplicably considering this was supposedly a greatest hits album, was a track I had not only never heard before, I had never heard it spoken of before. I immediately put Bad Boy on my Spotify and for the first time ever listened to this rock and roll cover of Larry Williams' song, led by John Lennon in full Dizzy Miss Lizzy mode. Okay, so it's not Carnival of Light, but the fact that this track hadn't revealed itself to me until now, having been a massive Beatles nerd since I was 15, was quite mind-blowing. Listen past the perfunctory and quite badly overdubbed lead guitar interjections. Maybe George was knackered from clubbing with Bob Dylan after his Royal Albert Hall performance the night before this session.
Yeah.
Good research, Leo.
Yeah, wow.
And the track was a blistering reminder of what an electrifying live act the boys must have been in their cavern in Hamburg days.
Yeah.
Aside from its first release in 1965 on Beatles 6, an album released only in North America, and Golden Oldies, deleted from the Beatles catalogue in 1987, the only other place this track saw a release was on the 1988 Past Masters CD box set. Mm. As someone born in the UK in 1990, this goes to explain how Bad Boy slipped through the cracks for me until now.
Yeah.
I wonder if you or your listeners have any other examples of these ghosts in the canon. Commercially released tracks only, please. Bootlegs don't count. Well, really driving this section.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great. I remember sort of seeing that in that box set. It's not one that I owned, but it doesn't spring to mind. I'm going to investigate.
I remember it being on Past Masters, but I always assumed it was a B-side of some kind, but obviously, yeah, but that, you know.
Yeah, it was a regular in those sort of crazily long Hamburg sets where they used to play, you know, 50, 60 different songs. Anyway, he says, thank you both for the fantastic podcast, which has become one of the highlights of my week. P.S. I'm 90% sure Jack was at my pub quiz at the Railway Tavern in Dalston last week. If so, I hope you had fun despite the lack of Beatles questions. And if not, ignore this bit. Well, Leo, you're absolutely right. I was there.
Great.
Came second. And won a bottle of wine, which I definitely shouldn't have drunk on the night. But yeah, it was an excellent quiz. If anyone lives in East London, then head to the Railway Table. Also an excellent pub. Have you ever been to the Railway in Dalston?
No, I haven't, no. That sounds fun. We should
absolute
do the quiz.
Cracker. A five-star pub.
Let's head down and do the quiz. I think that's an interesting question. I mean, like, because I feel like I've heard every Beatles song that's been released now. But like, I do think if you're a casual listener... then definitely there are always things that will surprise you. I mean, I think there are, you know, it feels like the White Album particularly has got little hidden corners that if you're not hugely familiar with the back catalogue, they can really surprise you, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, even those sort of the remixes, not even the remixes, but some of the sort of stereo stuff that I know the mono versions better, I find little, you know, bits of hidden horn parts on Abbey Road that I haven't heard before or whatever, you know. But yeah, for a whole song that has been released on a best of, or ostensibly a best of, that's pretty extraordinary. I'm just going to read one more quick one out because I really like this one.
Mm.
It's from Graham McCary, and he says, hi, Jack. Only recently discovered your own personal Beatles, but now enjoying it immensely. Felt moved by Matthew Crosby's episode to share this with you. I also have a great affection for the Give My Regards to Broad Street soundtrack, having found the cassette in my local record shop whilst at the height of my initial teenage Beatles obsession. A couple of years ago, in the Oxfam record shop on Victoria Road in Glasgow, I found it on vinyl for the princely sum of £2.99 and had to have it. Whilst queuing to pay for it, I discovered that it had been signed. I opted to stay quiet about this and made my purchase as quickly as possible. This is pretty incredible. Once back out on the street, it was quickly apparent to me that it was a phony signature. Not only does it not look like the great man's distinctive signature, but it was also misspelled.
Misspelled Paul McCartney.
And he's sent some photos of it as well.
That's great.
It's spelled Paul McCartney with one C.
Ah.
Yeah, probably a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's I mean, to be honest, I don't know how much a genuinely signed version of Give My Regards to Broad Street would match.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just added to the extra layer of delight for me, and I'll treasure it. On my next visit, I picked up Ram. Result. Keep up the great work, guys, and thank you. Thank you, Graham. What a great email. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's good. That reminds me, I remember being on tour once and those that we were staying, I think there's a venue where they had a guest book and, you know, you got they got bands to sign there and someone had written U2 and they'd just written Bono, The Edge, the drummer, the bass player, which was good. It's funny.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, phony Beatles signatures, there's a lot of fun to be had there.
Right, yeah.
I bought a copy of a Jimi Hendrix album when I was in my teens that was signed by like four different people. And it looked like, it was like, why would anyone sign this? And I think it was signed by someone, obviously not Jimi Hendrix, or but it might have been like the engineer or something like that.
Right. That's cool.
But yeah, I might throw that one out there on social, see if anyone knows what that is. If you want to hear an extended version of this episode and all our other episodes, as well as bonus content, we've got some really exciting stuff coming up, then you can go to patreon.com/personalbeatles. We went to Abbey Road this week with Ellis James, and we've got an episode recorded about our reaction to that, which was an unbelievable evening that we won't go into here. But if you want to hear that, then sign up. And we've also got a few surplus Your Own Personal Beatles mugs, which we usually just give to guests, so they're in high demand, but we've got a few left over, so I will raffle one of those off once a month for Patreon subscribers, so as if there wasn't enough to be excited about being on a Patreon. That's a little extra goodie for you. One more bit of housekeeping. There's a bit in the show where we talk about Graham Coxon writing the soundtrack of a show. Neither of us could remember what show it was, but it was The End of the Effing World. On Channel 4 Now on Netflix. So, yeah, if you're wondering. But anyway, we won't keep you any longer. Please do keep on sending your emails in. Follow us on social media and rate the show. That's very helpful if you're an Apple Podcasts listener. It really does help us get up the charts so other people can find us and we get, you know, featured and all of that. So really, really helpful. And we'll be back at the end. Enjoy this fantastic episode with the brilliant Laura Barton.
So this week on Your Own Personal Beatles, we're delighted to welcome the journalist, broadcaster and novelist Laura Barton. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
How's it going? How's your week been?
My week has been bananas, as I've been telling you off mic. But what I didn't tell you was my favourite part of the day, which was I've written, I think it's four articles today, and I'd written one Wolf Alice interview. And then I was finishing a Duran Duran interview and my doorbell rang and I went to it and there was a man saying it was a wardrobe delivery. And apparently I had a wardrobe delivery. I was a bit like, what wardrobe? I did actually have a wardrobe delivery today and it's now just standing in my hall. I don't know what to do with it. I hadn't cleared a space for it. I just had to crack on with my Duran Duran.
Can I guess two options that have caused this? One is that you ordered a wardrobe while drunk, and the other is you ordered it on Maid, and it takes so long to get there that you forgot you'd ordered it.
I think it's more likely the first because I've measured it and it doesn't fit in the space that it's meant to fit. So it's just a hall wardrobe now. I don't know what I'm going to
do. Okay, well, then we all need a hall wardrobe, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Duran Duran, am I right in thinking Graham Coxon has joined Duran Duran? I just saw
He has. I don't think as a permanent fixture, but he has, yeah. The tracks are really good. Yeah, they were very nice to interview.
He's not really a natural fit, I would have thought, would slip into Duran Duran. Is he doing it just a record? He's not sort of going on tour with them or anything?
They're only playing, I think, in the autumn, sort of Isle of Wight and stuff, so I think he'll be on those. I don't know for certain, maybe speaking out of turn, but I used to live quite close to Graham and know him a little bit, and having spent 2 hours in the company of Duran Duran, I cannot see that personality intersection, but I think it'll be, he is really good on it. He's very good.
Oh, cool. Have you ever come across his Beatles supergroup that he's in with Matt Bellamy and some other people?
I've never seen it, but I have heard thereof, yes.
I think they only sort of play like celebrity birthday bashes and things.
Quite rightly,
but,
yes.
But again, Matt Bellamy and Graham Coxon, not really
no
immediate connection.
Yeah.
No, he's a shapeshifter.
He's done quite a lot of the jobbing. He's kind of a bit like the Johnny Marr kind of his era in a way, because he's done quite a few kind of session-y jobs, hasn't he, and things like
that. He has, and he also do the soundtrack to
Oh, yeah, it was something really good. I know.
Yeah, it was like the two kids who would just kind of go on the run or whatever it is. That makes it sound rubbish, but it was quite funny. It was British. Anyway, it was really good.
So you've mentioned in an email before that you came on that growing up in the Northwest, there was a sort of sense of ownership of the Beatles and a kind of a deep connection, I suppose. Was that so? What was it like growing up? We're kind of similar age, I think. So what was it like kind of growing up in that area?
I do wonder if it's still the same now. I feel very much I grew up in a sort of post-Beatles Northwest, if that makes sense. So I think, you know, our parents, they were still the band for all our parents' generation. And in school, sometimes sort of in primary school, whatever, you would have to sing Beatles songs. Sort of, I don't really know why. But it was just sort of a glue. Yeah. And it was a bit like in the 80s in the Northwest, you had to love either Liverpool or Everton. That was sort of the law. And you had to love the Beatles. That was kind of it. But there were so many things that I didn't know about them. They were just sort of a fixed point. But I mean, I knew my mum had been to see them play in Wigan and back in the day.
Wow.
Is that a venue that still exists?
I don't think so.
When you were growing up?
No, I don't think really any venues exist in Wigan. I think when the casino went, they just burned everything down and built a shopping centre.
It's funny when you look at some of the venues that were on those, especially the early tours, in sort of more provincial places, and they're all just banks and post offices now and iron TK Maxx's and things. There's hardly any of them that are still there.
I mean, I think it may have been what became the cinema, the Rio Cinema, but I may be wrong about that.
And does your mum remember much about it, the gig, or she was it?
She was right down the front, which is really uncharacteristic for my mum.
Right.
That was the weirdest thing about the entire story. Just imagining my tiny little mother down the front.
Was she a full-on Beatlemaniac? Screaming?
No, she wasn't. I mean, she liked them. They loved music, but it wasn't. You know, we weren't a full-on Beatles household either. You know. I remember probably listening to more solo Paul McCartney when I was very young. And, Sergeant Pepper. I mean, that was a fixture. Where did you two grow up?
I grew up in Bristol, and Jack's grew up in Oxford.
And I'm sort of, Oxfordshire, So no sort of, nothing to really answer the Beatles in Oxford, really, and especially before my time.
Well, I think that this is the funny... My dad was going to see... saw the queue at the Colston Hall to buy a ticket, but it was too long, so he just didn't bother. But I think, weirdly, didn't your dad go to that gig, Jack?
My dad did go to see it, and I incorrectly said it was when they were supporting Helen Shapiro, but he told me the other day it was actually Brendel Lee.
Oh, right, nice.
As they pronounce it in Bristol.
Yeah, Brendel.
Nice.
The Colston Hall. But he wasn't really into it. My dad by that point was a bit of a sort of unfashionable, he was in sort of Duke Ellington and things like that.
Right.
And
the Beatles
was a sort of bit of a passing phase that was a bit naff and hysterical.
How right he was.
What a waste.
But so with solo McCartney, then you said in your email that you had a sort of bizarre misconception that you thought the McCartney albums were banned or something. Is that right?
I mean, when I think back to when I was little now, I do think about these peculiar stories that I sort of believed were true. Like, I thought my dad had played cricket for Lancashire, for example, for a really long time. I mean, of course he hadn't. But like, in a similar way, we had this family stereo in a sort of antique sideboard, and for some reason the tapes, some of the tapes were slightly under the sideboard, and I didn't know why they were. And I think probably somebody said flippantly they were hiding from the police or something, and I was like, oh god. You know, I was only about five. But I carried this sort of for a really long time.
Wow.
And I suppose it melded with things like...
justice.
I was always scared. Do you remember in the 80s and they would have those things about you must not pirate copy a tape?
Yeah.
You wouldn't steal a handbag.
Yeah. And I think I just melded all these things together so that Paul McCartney... I think in my head, Paul McCartney had left the Beatles and was not allowed, therefore... to record anymore, but he'd secretly made these albums. I think now I dwell on it that was probably the narrative I'd created.
Right. So yeah. He's a sort of outlaw.
Yeah. Yeah, the outlaw of Ram. So, yeah.
Do you still love Ram, like, all these years later? Because it's definitely one of those albums where it's gone through phases of being appraised and then wildly overpraised, I think. Where, you know, rightfully so, but it's just strange how McCartney's reputation, particularly McCartney 2, where it was like such a throwaway and, sort of, you know, it's debatable whether people really hated him that much in the 80s. I don't think anyone really ever hated him. But, like, it's weird how those albums are so cool
yeah,
now,
yeah.
You know, Ram and 2. Do you still like them?
Yeah, or absolutely. I don't listen to them that often. Isn't Ram's just about to be released, right?
Yeah.
I think it's his 50th birthday yesterday.
I seem to be getting a lot of press releases about it. I'm just like, I do still love it. Yeah, I do still love a lot of that music. I mean, it's the music of childhood, along with sort of Supertramp and John Betjeman and all that kind of stuff. So it occupies that strange space in your head, you know, when you're...
Banana Blush, the Betjeman albums?
Banana Blush and Late Flowering Love, yes.
Yeah. They're fantastic.
Yeah, they're amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that, isn't it? Because they're so... I mean, yeah, my dad had those on vinyl as well. And yeah, it's just weird. Everything's such a mishmash, isn't it, of your parents' record collection, but has such a deep impact. And you realise afterwards that some of those records were quite weird.
<You know? laughs> Yeah, there's no hierarchy at all either, is there, when you're a kid? It's just all, they're all just music. It's all just music. And I do think those, because I think the Betjeman ones were probably the first records I ever heard. And I think that probably did meld a lot with sort of music and words in my brain. It must have done. But so that and a lot of Van Morrison and Tubular Bells, which I still can't listen to this day.
Really?
It really upsets me.
Oh, right. So it's got bad connotations from childhood, or it's just you've over-listened to, or just...
I have really distinct memories before I could speak. And I spoke really late in life. Right. I was one of those weird children. And before I could speak, I just wanted them to turn it off. Turn fucking mic off.
Right, yeah.
I just wanted them to turn it off.
Wow,
all the time.
That's...
And they played it all
incredible.
The time.
What a vivid memory. Wow.
What was it about it that you found sort of upsetting? Was it just sonically or just...
Yeah. Yeah, it's too jangly. It's too much.
There was a lovely interview with Suggs from Madness where he talked about the Betjeman records and what an influence they were on Madness, which you wouldn't hear at all, but there is something of that very Englishness and the kind of... And also, you know, Suggs was saying he's talking about places in London he knew, even though it was a different generation. It's quite... They're really lovely. Do you know them, Jack, those Betjeman?
I know, I was about to say, I'll be the voice of the sort of uneducated being. I thought you were talking about the poet.
He did a couple of records with a really good...
Jim Parker.
Yeah, that really good sort of session band, and they're kind of very beautiful sort of Baroque pop arrangements behind.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so there's even some sort of slightly reggae numbers. I mean, it's peculiar.
Yeah, yeah.
They were reviewed in the NME. They were like really... You know, they just sat between lots of spaces, but they're really beautiful.
Yeah.
In among the silver birches, winding ways of tarmac wander, and the signs to Bussock Bottom, Tussock Wood, and Windy Break, gabled lodges, tile-hung churches, catch the lights of our Lagonda as we drive to Wendy's party, lemon curd and Christmas cake.
I mean, in a funny way, I mean, it's not an amazing comparison, but they're almost like a Serge Gainsbourg in the sense that he was narrating words over the top of these amazing session musicians, and the result's quite weird, but it worked, you know. But yeah, something like that. I was going to ask you, so we both really enjoyed your radio series, Notes on Music, which you can listen to on iPlayer at the moment. Okay. And you started that with an episode called 17, which mentioned when I saw her standing there.
Yes.
So what drove you to kind of create that episode? What do you think is so important about the age 17?
I had actually pitched it as an article to The Guardian about 10, 15 years ago. And that their music editor didn't see the value in it. And I was like... and then we got asked to do this series, and the producer and I had talked about a couple of ideas already, and we needed one more, and we came up with this. I think it was something, it was a producer I've worked with quite a bit, and I think it was probably a subject we talked about quite a bit, and we both interviewed Sharon Van Etten, and we both loved the 17 song. I loved being 17, and I'm always really fascinated by music that we listen to as teenagers, and sort of how that shapes us and all that kind of stuff, and how that's actually still a lot of the sort of attraction even to later music. We're still sort of always, there's a little wisp of that in a lot of the music we continue to like for the rest of our lives, I think. So yeah, it was sort of all about that. And then there were just so many bloody songs that mentioned 17.
It's interesting you loved being 17. I definitely had a more... So I was listening to that the other day and thinking about all the records that meant so much to me when I was 17. I think I was very ambivalent about being 17, but definitely musically and in terms of the Beatles. I think 17 was when I discovered Revolver, which had always eluded me. So that album is sort of being, you know, smoking fags, driving around in a little Peugeot 205 down the Bambury Road and just being horrendous.
Good.
But... yeah, I love that line that one of your contributors says, that it's like being 17 is like playing at real life with live ammunition.
Yeah, David Hepworth said that. Which is perfect.
Yeah, that's the best way of summing up what it is to be 17 that I've ever heard. And you can imagine if you were 17 and sort of, God, I'm almost worried about how obsessive I would have been with the Beatles if I had been 17 when Revolver actually did come out.
Yeah. I mean, I was probably... not dissimilar in a way, in that I'd probably parked the Beatles for years. And then when I was 17 and started, I mean, I started going out to pubs and clubs and things quite young, but probably when I was around the 17 is when I met people who were really obsessive about the Beatles when I went to sixth form. And when they started playing them more in clubs again. And I do remember being at somebody's birthday party, and they'd hired like a sort of hall kind of thing, you know, like a church hall, and they were playing Why Don't We Do It in the Road, and the idea of dancing to that was just huge to me. I mean, so it was beyond Sergeant Pepper. Amazing. At that point for me.
So what was your 17 year old self's biggest sort of musical obsession? Was it, were you already into sort of Springsteen and things at that point?
I was, but I was very into Pixies. I was very into Velvet Underground, probably Pulp. I mean, it was Britpop. It was sort of that sort of grunge going into Britpop era then. So everyone you could possibly imagine then. And my friend, my best friend Joe, and I blagged our way into the studios in Manchester for where Mark Radcliffe used to record his show. We sat in on sessions by Belly and the Blue Tones and things like that. So,
amazing. Yeah. That's so cool. I mean, that was such a... as I said before, like the reason I think I love your writing so much is because it's a similar... I feel like I'm 40, so it's a similar kind of generational thing where, for me, it was, you know, I remember you talking once about wearing your Adidas shell top. And but there is that kind of the Britpop thing, which is obviously Beatles, and then, you know, all those kind of things, and then kind of growing up and you've got more into the like Americana thing, and that's definitely where my musical tastes went. But definitely Mark Radcliffe and Mark Riley, that was so formative for me, because it was an incredible radio show because as well as all this music, you'd have, you know, Mark Kermode coming on talking about films and Simon Armitage talking about books. I feel like it was just my sentimental education, you know. But like, I learned so much from it. Definitely.
It was a little kingdom in itself, wasn't it? And actually, Joe, who I mentioned then, is my best friend, and we met at sixth form. But the summer before we met, I remember listening to Mark Radcliffe, and someone had sent in a postcard from Florida. Just saying he was loving being on Florida with his family, but missing listening to the show. And he said, and that's from Joe from Wigan. And I remember thinking, God, I wish I knew people like that who listened to Mark Radcliffe, even though I'm living in Wigan. And then we met, and it was like a lovely little...
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah.
But the footwear thing, you're saying about the Adidas, and I don't think we can underestimate the joy of having worn sort of... I used to wear those paratrooper boots, but having gone from the weight of paratrooper boots to going to Adidas... There was sort of this new springiness to everything because your feet weren't as heavy. It's quite delightful.
Yeah. I suppose, the kind of going from plaid shirts to a tight T-shirt, Adidas T-shirt,
is
a big change in style. Yeah.
Massive. Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, I've gone back to plaid shirts now because I can't do
haven't
tight
we all?
T-shirts anymore.
Me neither, it's fine.
No. Cool. So yes, and I loved the second episode as well, which I think there's a lot of room to talk about Beatles in this because it was called Happy Sad, and it was a really beautiful episode because you talked about the kind of emotional resonance of music and how it has its own kind of emotional language, and how that kind of in a way hasn't changed over centuries and how you use this kind of motif of this, like a kind of descending bass line or descending melody, which is used in countless songs, going back hundreds of years. Using Purcell's Dido's Lament as an example.
Yeah.
The thing I was thinking of when I was listening to it was this, this is so Beatlesy, isn't it? Because there are so many Beatles songs with either descending chords or descending bass lines or, you could so many, Dear Prudence.
Yes, I was thinking about that earlier, actually. Yeah. And I was thinking actually too about the fact that the way that your relationship with an album, particularly with a Beatles album, I think really shifts. And probably, when I first would hear it when I was a very small child, you always love, When I'm 64 or whatever. And then you go into liking the sadder, A Day in the Life or She's Leaving Home or whatever. And they must have those descending chords, I'm guessing, those happy sad ones.
Yeah, For No One is probably the most prominent one that I remember first being like, oh, this is the Aeneist. Because I think John Lennon's probably a bit more subtle in the way that he used them, whereas Paul is Baroque pop.
Cry Baby Cry. It's beautifully descending kind of. But there is, but the point of the episode is there's something, I mean, it's in the blues, but this idea that as you're descending, you kind of know what's coming because you know you're going down another step, and it sort of has this world weariness to it, and it's kind of, yeah. But it's, again, because it's music, it's impossible to define what it is, but it is sad.
It's also a lot of the sort of thinking around is it that it mimics those human sighs or boo hoo hoo or even the shape of the face, which slumps when you're sad, or the slope of your shoulders. And all of those things, hearing those sounds stimulate certain hormones within us so that there is a degree of pleasure and self-soothing by listening to sad music. I've got a book out next year which is about sad music. So.
Oh, really?
Oh, nice.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Hence, I can waffle on about it.
You Never Give Me Your Money is the one I always think of when I think of that sort of very melody, because it's got those sort of downward 9/8 suspensions for me is always... where it is in terms of that sort of, it's a slight, well, it's that kind of yearning, but it's only a step down from the note where you're sort of supposed to be. So it's, and that is very much the same as the as the Purcell.
Yeah.
Or Purcell, as I've realised everyone knows.
We my producer
was it always Henry Purcell?
Yes. I had to re-record that section because recording radio during the pandemic is really quite difficult. So, and I don't really know a great deal about classical music, whereas my producer knows loads. He studied it. And so he came out with all these notes where it was like Purcell. And I just done all this.
Sounds too washing powdery for me. I'm going to stick with Purcell, I think.
Yeah.
But I mean, I only just discovered, well, fairly recently, the jazz guitarist is called Pat Metheny. And I've been calling him Pat Metheny for, you know, 40.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a few.
But Metheny sounds like methane.
Yeah. He should rethink that.
Metheny's so much cooler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. Did you have a sort of predilection for sad music when you were sort of, well, throughout your whole life? I mean, I definitely do.
Yeah. All the best people do. I mean, yes, I definitely. Definitely, always have done, and it's been really fascinating to sort of look more closely at it and work out why and all those kinds of things, and everything from shape note singing in the US to, you know, Fado, you know, which some people call the saddest music in the world, and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of them rest on that sort of essential idea of you can't. Of suspension, actually, and you can't go home again, you know, whether it's Duende or whether it's, you know, Ghazals in South Asia, you know, they rest on this sort of limbo of desire and longing for someone that you love and you can't have, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and can I ask Jack a kind of musical question while if we can get technical? Because in the radio show, you mentioned the famous Spinal Tap quote that D minor is the saddest of all keys. But I've never quite understand. I mean, I think
that's
thought
just a throwaway joke, though. I don't think there's
but
any.
But there's loads of books that are about studying it. That's in my book as well. I can't remember all of them, but for like centuries, different musicologists tried to assign different emotions to different keys.
I think G major is definitely a happier key, and what most people seem to say, and also C sharp minor is the one a lot of people say is one of the saddest, probably because it's fucking pain to play.
Well, that's the thing. I'm thinking it must relate really sad to it must relate to the music in some way, because you know, as a guitarist, I feel like if you're playing an E minor or E major, it's going to be lower, going to be bassier, and whereas if you're playing D, it's going to be lighter because the D shape is using higher.
But I
always thought the Spinal Tap joke was a joke because there's no such thing as a sad key because all keys are fundamentally the same. Or am I completely naive?
I mean, I don't. There's definitely. I mean, from my personal experience and from doing composition or whatever, there are certain. I would never write something that I thought was going to be very sad in something like A minor, because for me it sounds. I think it's more. It has a different quality. I think.
Really?
I don't know. It's probably also to do with the where your hands fall when you're playing a piano. So if I'm playing, you know, something like "You Never Give Me Your Money" or "Golden Slumbers" has that starts with that beautiful A minor seventh or whatever it is. That's where your kind of hands naturally fall. So that's probably the reason why that's written in that key.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, I don't know. Laura will probably, she's writing a book. More than I will.
Suzanne Vega said a great thing about you don't need to know many chords because A minor contains like all the sadness of the world or something. Didn't she? There's,
but,
I'm going to have
I
to look
know,
up this quote.
I should probably feed that. I'm still doing edits, so we could probably feed that in still. But people dispute that, you know, like I think Beethoven, what did he call the saddest key? The black key. It's
the black key. It was B minor.
Like B minor, yeah.
I might be wrong.
This is Suzanne Vega. All the mysteries of life come in A minor. I quite like that.
Also, Alicia Keys. But for years, I thought that composers just wrote in very difficult keys, just sort of out of spite. Really,
I think they do. I still think
show that they could.
Yeah, there's a lovely bit in a Nicholson Baker book where he talks about Debussy's Submerged Cathedral. I'm not going to say it in French, but he talks about how brilliant it is that it's in C. It's because it just feels so kind of clear. I kind of weirdly
clear,
get that
yeah.
on the piano. Playing in C major, it's like this. Well, like, yeah, kind of. It's beautiful the way it kind of you hear it. The cathedral kind of becoming unsubmerged.
Yeah.
You know, it comes out of the waters.
But it's often about where you end up with Debussy, not where you start.
That's really?
Yeah. Well, it's about its whole tone, isn't it?
So yeah.
It's,
yeah.
Exactly. About the journey, not the destination.
Exactly.
For sure. That's not too bogged down in harmonic colour.
Yeah.
I know, I just want that as like a live, laugh, love poster now. Is,
yeah, put it next to my Prosecco o'clock.
Yes.
I was going to ask, as we're saying, kind of. I sort of identified with the music you listened to growing up, which included the Beatles. And then for me, when I was about 18 or 19, I got so heavily into Bonnie Prince Billy. And I know that's you're a huge fan of his as well. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's not really a Beatles link, because, and God knows I've tried to find one in the last... but I do think that even though this was... I mean, I remember hearing it on John Peel for the first time, Another Day Full of Dread. Mm. And I just remember like that voice and the scratchiness of it and the kind of... the how like someone talking to you it was, the voice, I suppose, and it sounded so real. And but then the thing that really what I loved about all those early Palace albums is the melody. Like, he's a brilliant writer of melodies, and I don't think I would have got that appreciation if I hadn't spent, you know, the last 10 years listening to basically the Beatles. So
yeah.
Like, I think the Beatles informed my like discernment of saying, oh, that's a good melody, oh, I like that. You know, I vividly remember, you know, getting the I See a Darkness album, just blowing me away. So I wonder, like, so what was your experience of that? You definitely got into that kind of American folk rootsy kind of music. How did that kind of happen for you?
I don't think I necessarily saw him as that initially. He was just this sort of isolated person who I thought was sort of mysterious and wonderful. It's not as if I didn't align him with other things. I loved the I See a Darkness album, early Palace stuff. I remember my boyfriend at the time worked in a record store and would sort of, you know, steal all the records and make compilations each week. and I think he probably introduced me to them, or maybe Joe actually. I remember really loving, was it Superwolf he did, Matt Sweeney in the...
Oh, yeah.
When you said about the melody, I immediately thought of that Bed Is For Sleeping track, which has the most extraordinary melody.
Bed is for sleeping, love is for making, and you know, love, I am yours for the taking. My eyes are for seeing, the wind is for blowing, and you see, love, I am yours for.
I think he probably made sense as well because I was already very into Bill Callahan, and I think I probably paired them in my head. I'd bought a Smog album after going to, I think, the first Bowley Festival at Camber Sands.
And
there was
pre-ATP.
Like, yeah, and and there was, maybe it was the first ATP even actually, and there was a little booklet. It probably was the first ATP. A booklet where you could, they did little descriptions of records that you could then send a check off, and then they would post them back to you in this sort of really time consuming retro way. I mean, it wasn't retro at the time, it was, that felt very modern. And I bought Smog Knock Knock through that, and a couple of other ones. So I probably was quite fascinated by those kinds of voices and that kind of Americanness. Mm. But I don't think I'd been to America briefly for a day once from Canada. I wasn't really interested in American culture in the way that I became. And then I probably got really into sort of more like the White Stripes and the Strokes and Moldy Peaches and that kind of stuff. And then came back into Americana, I suppose. That's a really sort of rambling answer for you.
No. I mean, it was a very, very un-Beatlesy question.
But you know, we can say that in a way it was a sort of back to the landishness, like Paul McCartney probably did. There's probably some kind of very tenuous link there for us.
Well, and definitely we're talking about, you know, the Joe from Wigan postcard. I love that era where it was slightly pre-internet, and so trying to get hold of all these things, like Will Oldham produced so much stuff that was really rare, and it was all about, you know, finding this CD in some record shop, or, you know, paying way over the odds for a Japanese-only kind of edition or something.
Sure, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, completely. And having the confidence in those days to go in to go into a record store and ask for something you didn't quite understand what it was. I mean, who was Bonnie Prince Billy, Will Oldham, Palace Brother? What was it? And who were they, and how did we unravel them? You know, that took a bit of guts at the time.
I remember, like, going to London to see him live, whenever we'd go and see him live, and, you know, again, pre-Google, trying to find the venue, and you just follow all these, like, blackroom spectacles-wearing people. Yeah. You're just like, that's so my people.
And those are my people, Yeah. I mean, that's funny. I guess, do we still have that as much now? There used to be that real thing. If you were just even walking through a town, you just saw one of your people, and there was almost a sort of slight nod. I don't know that people do that so much.
Yeah.
Maybe they do. We're just older.
I mean, I met someone at uni because they were wearing a Belle and Sebastian t-shirt, like someone I know now and I'm still friends with.
Yes, me too. I've done that. Yeah.
I used to live very near Brixton Academy, and it was always quite a fun game playing, looking at everyone getting off the tube and guessing the band. You know, obviously t-shirts gave the game away, but it was, I think it was relatively easy to, you could narrow it down to sort of three or four bands.
There's a very funny ticket tout outside Brixton Academy, isn't there? Because, like, sometimes, like, the really weird band names, at least obviously never heard of them. Tyler the Creator! It's really good. That's great.
I just feel it makes me feel ill every time, because all through my youth it was T-shirt Survivor, really tops a tenner.
Yes.
No, you wouldn't get. You can't even get a pint for a tenner.
No, not in London.
So, Laura, your cat is called Paul.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
McCartney.
No, my first cat was called Paul.
Former cat?
First cat.
Your first cat.
Former cat.
Rest in peace, Paul McCartney. In fact, he got very chubby, and he became known as Fat Paul. And then he ran off to live on a farm. But now I think about it, may have been my parents not telling us that he'd...
Well, in character.
Yes, in character.
Well, maybe he just meant to make a divisive record in Scotland.
Well, the cat version of Mull of Kintyre would be something to behold, I think.
Yeah. So did you never had a sort of Johnny Renaissance I suppose that sort of scratchiness that you're talking about and the kind of, you know, there's that authenticity is kind of there in 70s solo John records where you just sort of, was it something at the time you weren't interested in?
I just didn't really know about it, to be honest. I mean, no criticism of my parents, but when I was younger, I didn't know about it. And I was thinking about this the other day because... Actually, when I was interviewing Duran Duran, because I was thinking about how I never was really into Duran Duran. They were slightly before my time. But I do remember these little magazines you used to get that would have whoever was the sort of reigning pop band and who was the sort of new upcoming pop band alongside them. So it'd be like Duran Duran versus A-ha. See what I mean? And I think I kept this sort of narrative in my head for quite a long time that it was always someone versus someone else, which makes me sound really competitive. I'm just completely not. But it was a bit like when grunge came along. I thought you couldn't like both Pearl Jam and Nirvana. You had to choose a team. And I think I felt a bit like that.
You still can't, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. yes. And I think I carried a little bit into John and Paul, really. And I guess I thought...
Right. That's interesting.
Mm.
I kind of probably thought John split up the Beatles and therefore was, I don't know. I just didn't. But then when I did hear those solo records, they blew my mind and I absolutely fucking loved them. Mm. And I interviewed Yoko Ono quite a few years back and and I loved her too. And I love her artwork and I have this reverence for them and this sort of sense of apology almost towards them that I didn't know about them for so long.
How was Yoko? That's amazing.
She was, I just loved her. She just had this great presence. It was during a time when I felt I did a run of sort of rock widow interviews of sort of Deborah Curtis and Courtney Love and Yoko. And Yoko was, you know, slightly batshit, but that's what you want from her. And then she gave, she gave me some gifts at the end, a little torch. And and a little one of those Physalis fruit things from the fruit bowl in the hotel. And
so it was just next to her, and she was like, she was "Have like, this.
Yeah. Anything is a gift. Yeah. Anything
and
is
some shampoo.
Yeah, from me. Please take all the miniature coffee filters." And she, I remember going. Maybe it was. It must have been before then. Being in Detroit, I've been to Detroit when sort of right at the height of the sort of garage rock revival thing going on in Detroit, and with my friend Amy, and we were walking home one night and stumbled across one of her artworks in the center of Detroit. It was this sort of it was a railroad carriage, and you could hear voices inside it. It was to commemorate some immigrants who had been stranded in the desert. Trying to make it into America in a railroad and then just abandoned in a carriage, trapped in a carriage and whatever. I mean, it was a really distressing story. But that was one of the things that sort of shifted my opinion of Yoko and what she might have been trying to do with her relationship with John, really, I suppose. And then that shifted my relationship again with the music and, slightly circuitous route to the John solo albums.
Yeah, the Plastic Ono Band album is... And the John Lennon solo in general, the stuff that I've definitely came to later. But I mean, I mean, listening to the reissue of the Plastic Ono Band, which came out the other week, which I think is fantastic, is. And the thing that strikes me, which I guess I didn't notice before, is I kind of categorize it into one of those albums like Astral Weeks or. In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, maybe, where it's really, it's just complete, you know, getting it all out there. It's so honest and beautiful. And you know, I mean, I think I knew songs before, like Love, and thinking they're a bit cheesy, because if you hear it out of context, it might sound like that. But then in the context of the album, it's just part of this just kind of just brutal honesty, which is just so amazing about that record.
No, exactly.
And that's kind of the respite in that record where, you know, something on Imagine, which would be a sort of something a bit more parodic. For that, you sort of lean in from sort of gut-wrenching, soul-spilling into just like sentiment. which is...
And I wonder, I mean, yeah. I don't know the answer to this, but the timing of it is interesting. I mean, they don't sound alike, but I wonder if John heard Astral Weeks, though. I don't know.
Almost. What's Astral Weeks? 69?
Probably, yeah.
69, he must have done.
Almost, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He must have done.
I don't think they're that similar, though, are they? But...
Well, similar in just how expressive, I suppose.
Yeah, as in sort of impressionistic stream of consciousness. So.
Yeah, and also release from previous sort of perceptions of you, that kind of thing. I think there's something probably quite similar with that. I have a funny, I mean, everyone has a funny relationship with Imagine, but when I took a gap year in the Middle East, I had to, I was with this group of people and we had to teach in a school for a bit. And I just remembered earlier that we all had to teach a Beatles song and I had to teach Imagine. So it's just, I just had memories of being like, sitting with a group of sort of 17-year-old Israelis going, what does Imagine make you think of?
Yeah.
Anyway.
And did it solve everything?
It did, and everything is fine now. That's good.
Oh, that's good.
You've seen in the news this week, yeah.
Yeah, Imagine is a weird one. I mean, like, that's the only solo record my dad had. He's had all the Beatles records and he had Imagine, which I think was the case for maybe a lot of people. And it's one of the ones I really loved it. And I absolutely loved How Do You Sleep. I just thought it was funny. I just thought it really rocked. I thought it's such a cool riff. But I just like, I just made me feel sad because it wasn't the Beatles when I was young, basically.
Yeah.
Like I didn't love it as much because it just made me feel sad.
Yeah, no, I can totally understand that. I think I also, just thinking about it now, probably had a slightly odd feeling towards John because so many young men when I was growing up tried to look like John Lennon in the Northwest.
Right.
You know, with the little buses and the haircut and whatever.
Yeah.
It was just this sort of felt try hard, and I put their try hardiness onto John himself, which was unfair of me, and I'd like to apologise to him if he's listening.
It's also incredibly hard to pull off that look as well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, probably... Liam Gallagher.
Yeah.
So you, as you mentioned, you sort of came of age right in the smack bang middle of Britpop. So when there was the big sort of Beatles renaissance that sort of happened around the anthology, was that something that you sort of got into, or did you kind of, you'd already done that?
I got into it. I just think there's just so much going on then that it...
Because it seemed a little bit cynical. I mean, I was pretty young.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was just on, you know, I'm a few years younger than Robin, so I remember sort of What's Story, Morning Glory, and I just felt like I was about 6 months too late to properly get into sort of Britpop. And by that time I already loved the Beatles and it just almost seemed like sort of pastiche.
Oh, it was total pastiche. And I worked in a record store at the time that What's the Story came out, and... it was quite astonishing how Beatles records, the sales of Beatles records went up at the same time as that all came out, you know, and it was a very strange time, but I don't think, I've never been a sort of big, I was going to say, I don't really like sort of box sets, anthologies, I don't really like anniversaries so much as my mentioning of, is there something going on with RAM at the moment? I mean, I don't, I occasionally get asked to write about these things and I will do it, but I just, I think at that age, you know, you're kind of more, certainly by the time Oasis were basically just playing at being the Beatles, it was a bit embarrassing. And again, you know, Oasis, a northern band, and I felt I was very into pulp and that was my Britpop, really. I found, you know, I liked the first Oasis record. That was exciting. I'd met them while I was on a caravan holiday in Penrith.
Really?
Some kind of claim to fame at that early stage, but yes.
What, was that when they were recording down there, or was it just
No, I have absolutely no idea why they were there. actually, maybe it was just Bone. The band used to come into Wigan to go to the Pier nightclub, because it was one of very few indie nightclubs in the Northwest and was quite fated for absolutely no reasons. do you know what? Maybe it was just Bonehead, because I remember we were in Penrith. I was only 16 or something. And we stayed in my grandparents' caravan, and then we were in a pub, me and my friend Janice, and we met this guy called Matthew, who was wearing, I don't know why I've remembered all this detail, wearing a Just Say No, like a Zamo t-shirt. And he told us about his cousin, who was Bonehead. And I think Bonehead and some of the others were there in this bar in Penrith. And he was like, yeah, they've just signed a big record deal. And we were like, yeah, whatever. We thought they were really square because they didn't have dreadlocks. We were just into dreadlocks at the time. That's a random Britpop grunge intersection for you.
Yeah. That's the most 90s statement ever made. Yeah. I wasn't into Oasis because they didn't have dreadlocks.
It would have been a very different
short hair, you say. No, it'll never catch on.
But there was that. It's interesting that, though, because, like, I remember, like, a couple of times where my brother would play me something and go, oh, listen to this, I just heard this. And one time was Smells Like Teen Spirit, and obviously mind blown. And the other time was Supersonic. And just, like, thinking that was just, you know, something about it was just completely amazing. And my brother's very good at listening to music and picking out things. And it's hard to think now with Oasis just how kind of, you know, they admit they became kind of quite, you know, a bit...
shite?
Shite. But, you know, at the time, it's just, there was so much... It was part of that kind of very interesting, like 93, 94 was very interesting because there was so much different music going on. And we kind of forget that, you know, everyone was listening to, like, you know, there was hip hop and drum and bass and there was indie and there's bands like Suede. And then Oasis releasing Supersonic was just like part of the melting pot, and it just sounded amazing, you know.
It really, really was. I mean, also things like, I know that they were later, Spice Girls, weren't they? But it was just like this sort of, I mean, I'm not saying I wasn't a big Spice Girls fan, but it was just like this bizarre collision of music.
Yeah.
That if you did go to like an indie night, the span of it was actually quite immense, you know.
I suppose it was the sort of peak of the power of, like, major record labels and indie record labels working in a sort of cohesive way with mainstream, whatever it was, Radio 1 or, you know, and just everything was so ubiquitous and seemed to be symbiotic for that brief period before the internet came and blew everything up. Like, it definitely felt like the bubble was burst in quite a spectacular way, which is why people still bang on about Britpop as the last time that we had a sort of, you know, a sort of shared cultural trajectory of what people were listening to.
Well, we also, when did Top of the Pops end, you know, because I think that was a sort of blueprint
later
for a lot of stuff.
I think. Yeah. Yeah, 2006 or something, but it had been dead in the water for 10 years or something.
Yeah. Because that was such a sort of blueprint for sort of cultural collision, and that it was allowed to have this random selection of music in one place. And then I do remember sitting on the kitchen table at home and reading Nirvana lyrics with my friend and us singing along to Nirvana, but with the lyrics from Smash Hits, which now seems nuts to me as well, you know, that a pop
that seems so
carried
weird,
Nirvana. Yeah.
I mean, I work in the MTV building, and the idea of Nirvana being anywhere near any MTV channel now is just sort of crazy, but that's the mainstream, was that was what it was. But I suppose going back to sort of that makes the Beatles' achievement even more incredible when you think of the spectacular success that people had in those times, and just no one was able to carry the pressure in the way that they did. And sort of, you know, the Beatles should have really made like a big coke-fueled mess record that was 3 hours long, or you know, that should have there be here now. But the fact that they made to something sort of cultivated and really,
or also like amazing that they didn't just do a really shit TV show that they got paid loads. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like Scott Walker had a TV show, which I'm sure was actually really good looking back. But like, you know, like The Beatles Presents, like a light entertainment show. They could have very easily gone down that route.
But they kind of, I mean, they almost did that, didn't they?
They did,
I suppose they were too big for the infrastructure of that sort of thing by that point.
Well, definitely in the early days. I mean, the
but Yellow Submarine, you know, they had their own film.
Like, and they did Pantos up until like 60.
Much later than you'd think.
Later than, I want to say 65, but it's probably 64. But they like, it was slightly
odd. Why didn't they make a really duff Coke? Is that because they had to make so much stuff or they made stuff faster, or was that because they had an art college background? Or
I think they just broke up at exactly the right time.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Like, I think if they'd been around like just a couple more years, they would have been the real Coke Frenzy album.
I think they also cared more than those people, though. I don't think they were really the sort of sheen of being like, you know, if you look at the sort of Gallaghers or a lot of people around in the 90s, a lot of that was about emulating what happened in the 60s and just being rock stars and being lads or whatever. It's like Beatles weren't really interested in that. Like the music always kind of came first, and they were much more interested in the craft than those people. So the stakes were higher for them to, and also I think they had a really good relationship with their own kind of legacy, whereas they believed the hype, but they were only competitive with themselves. So I think that helps. Yeah,
definitely. Mm. It's also weird to think that, you know, the song Let It Be, like that came about because Paul McCartney had been doing way too much coke. Yeah. I've been taking too much. And that's like such a weird cocaine. So it's not how other kind of coke songs sound.
But I can't imagine Paul McCartney on coke. That to me in itself
no,
is
me
such
neither.
A weird image.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's like. Yeah, so I think they're just the very different personalities. They weren't kind of...
Maybe it was just better coke, I don't know. In those
Yeah.
But it's like that thing you're saying of, like, you know, everyone has to have a comparison with which to measure sort of any sort of cultural phenomenon, which is where, you know, you have Beatles and Stones and you had Lennon-McCartney post-Beatles. And I think with Britpop, there was a... Actually, the comparison to the 60s is not very apt, I don't think.
No, and I think also in the 90s, people were really looking for a cultural moment.
Yeah.
Because I remember that there was a Guardian thing in the 90s where it was like, oh, 66 was a great year, 77 was a great year, the year of punk, 88 was the second Summer of Love, 99's going to be good. And it was like, Travis, The Man Who, which is a good album.
Yeah,
but you know,
I found the sort of soggy end of that of Britpop quite hard. Well, you know, when it got
to that
Travis
was a bit and we needed the Strokes. Let's say we needed the Strokes.
we desperately needed the Strokes.
But I think that was part of the 90s way of where it became a decade of looking back and nostalgia, where it was really it was about trying to find that defining moment, and it maybe not often arriving.
Yeah,
or maybe it was just it wasn't where we were looking, I guess, is probably
it wasn't it wasn't guitar music, for example. It was going on elsewhere. I really wanted to ask you about Van Morrison. Do you mind talking about this?
No, I'm traumatised. Of course, no, it's completely fine. It's completely fine.
So, like, I'm sure some listeners may know that Laura Barton interviewed Van Morrison a couple of years ago, and it was definitely one of his notoriously uncommunicative interviews. And I just wondered, like, how do you feel now? And I wondered also, have you read the Will Hodgkinson interview with him that was in the Times a couple of weeks ago?
Where he was nice to him.
A, Van Morrison was really nice. B, Will Hodgkinson, great writer, but didn't really challenge him on the COVID scepticism and some of the other, like, actually pretty unsavoury implications of the new album, which is like songs like there's a song called They Run the Media or something, or They Run
Oh,
the
yeah,
News.
There's that, yeah.
So I wonder, like... so I wonder, how do you feel now about that interview after this has happened to Van? And
that interview was funny. I mean, I should say, and I've said it in other places before, that I had been trying to interview Van for years. Every time he would have a new album, I would say to whoever's doing his PR, you know, I'd love to do this interview. I've been listening to Van Morrison. He's like the sort of, apart from Bruce Springsteen, in fact, way back before Bruce Springsteen, he's been this sort of force, you know, in my life, because my parents were huge Van Morrison fans. So I know so much about him. I know his music intimately. But every time it would go to other people, and when I say people, I mean white men of a certain age. And you know, I remember when he did a jazz album, I got asked by management to send effectively my jazz CV. I had to prove how much I knew about jazz. And it just so happens that I do actually know quite a bit about jazz because my dad is jazz. But I remember thinking, Michael Hann, another Guardian colleague or former Guardian colleague, he interviewed Van for a blues record. I don't think he had to send his blues CV. So, I'm just going to make the point that I'm not surprised he got on well with Will. I mean, Will's a good friend of mine. I'm not surprised he got on well with Will and with a lot of other, and with Michael Hann, who doesn't really know anything about Van Morrison. There's a shared factor there. As regards that interview, it has not affected how I feel about his music. I mean, his back catalogue. I still love it. One of the things I did after the interview is I went back to my hotel room and I listened to I made myself listen to Lyndon Arden. The frustrating thing about that interview is he was, so willfully not showing the beautiful side of himself, which I do think he clearly has in him. And it was such a peculiar setup. As regards his new stuff, I mean, what can you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost not worth paying any attention to.
Yeah.
I can't bring myself to listen to it because it's just...
Not listened to.
It's just like a neighbour sounding off.
Yeah, yeah. Completely. And I thought Alexis Petridis's review in The Guardian
was hilarious. Yeah.
Impeccable review. So
he said he surprised there isn't a song on there complaining about the parking by the school or that the repair shop is the best thing on TV nowadays. Yeah. So it was very, very funny. Yeah.
I mean, I think...
Yeah, I think that's a good thing with Van, that he has such a strong back catalogue, which is so old now, and it's so easy to make that distinction between who Van is now and who he was then. Mm. Yeah, I haven't listened to the new stuff, but it hasn't stopped my enjoyment of Astral Weeks and Veden Fleet and those records at all.
I would love him to work with, and I kind of broached it in the article, but in the interview, but I'd love him to work with some of the new British jazz players, or American. I'd love him to work with Bon Iver. Yeah. I'd love him to work with really interesting musical minds who could communicate with him.
Yeah, like a Yusuf Davies Van Morrison record.
Just like someone who pushes him.
It's especially at a time where there seems to be so many sort of septa-octogenarians making such incredible music with a real kind of, still with all that, their fire is still there, but with, I mean, I suppose with Van Morrison hasn't been there for years, but...
But because for someone so interested in money, which, let's face facts, is why he's complaining about lockdown, is I'm surprised, like Tom Jones did a brilliant thing. Tom Jones did a kind of quite straightforward bluesy record a while ago, kind of in the light of the Johnny Cash kind of ones. Really good. But there was an interview with Tom Jones where he said, if that's what's selling, I want to do that. Like that kind of thing. And that could be Van. Why isn't Van doing
Van
his hurt moment?
Started churning out those records after his very expensive divorce, I think, really. I remember my dad, who is an accountant, sort of saying that smacks of somebody's got a massive tax bill. He just kept doing, here's a blues record, here's a jazz record, here's a whatever. And then when he was doing those, actually, though, I was quite hopeful. I saw him at a tiny gig in West London, and he was happy. It was the first time in a long time I'd seen him happy, and I thought, out of these sort of covers albums, I think something really special is going to happen. And I think probably I blew it for everybody by pissing him off. I mean, look, apparently he liked my interview. That was the shocking thing.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Apparently he said, I got it. It was about the music.
Really?
I mean, I could have written it far more cruelly.
One question that we ask everyone on the podcast is, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I don't listen to them that often, I'm going to be honest. Yeah. I mean, that's whenever I hear them, I have
on this
like...
podcast.
Sorry, everyone. Whenever I do, I think, God, this band are great. not in a kind of, they're going to do well, but more of aren't we lucky to have this huge supply of songs? There's nothing like cleaning the house and putting on the Beatles and being like, oh my God, every single song is majestic.
So that was our brilliant chat with Laura Barton. I really enjoyed that one. What did you think?
Yeah, it was I thought it was just really lovely to talk to her. I think she's got such a sensitive, intelligent way of talking about music. And it's refreshing. She's not afraid to be sincere about music, I think, you know. And, I mean,
it's not really been a problem for you or I.
Yeah, that's true. But, I loved hearing those kind of... I mean, it just makes me think the podcast is really about formative experiences with music, isn't it? That's what we always come back to. So it's always about these kind of music you heard as a kid and the effect it kind of has on you. But, yeah, really good episode.
Yeah, another one that could have just gone on and on and on.
Yeah.
I think I did mention, we talked about Beethoven's use of B minor.
Yeah.
I think it's actually C minor.
Oh, you idiot.
Which is a relatively, actually very uncommon key in the classical period, but yeah. Beethoven bloody loved the guy.
Right. And we managed to avoid the topic of Springsteen.
Yes.
Which is, because she is a huge Springsteen fan.
And Jack and I am not.
Not so much. I mean, I like him, but I'm not a huge fan. But we did manage to kind of navigate around talking about that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, I sort of have a kind of a preternatural hatred of him due to the amount of stuff I missed at Glastonbury 2009, because I had to sit through 3.5 hours of that.
Anyway.
Good stuff. Well, thank you very much for listening. Do you join the Patreon if you would like to hear a extended version of that and all other episodes. As mentioned at the beginning of the show, we've got a brilliant episode with Ellis James where we went around Abbey Road and got stupidly emotional about pieces of recording equipment. And that's a really, really fun one. You can go to patreon.com/personalbeatles and keep following us on the social medias, and we'll see you next Tuesday. A great episode coming up with Jim Murray.
It's a really interesting episode, actually, with Jim Murray. Jim is a folk musician, an English folk musician, brilliant songwriter, arranger, singer of traditional songs. And, yeah, we talk a lot about the folk world, how that interacts with the Beatles. There's an album called Rubber Folk, which Jim Murray features on, which is folk... singers singing Beatles songs, which is really good. And we also talk about Bright Phoebus, which is the kind of lost album by Lal and Mike Waterson, which is often called the kind of Sergeant Pepper of the folk world. So it's kind of a really interesting kind of wide-ranging chat about folk music in general as well. So it's a really good one.
So all that to look forward to next Tuesday. We'll see you then.
Bye!
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.